The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 2 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. This will be the inauguration of a short series. I extrapolate probably 5 to 10 episodes in which I will try to repress my normally curmudgeonly ways and stop complaining persistently about the state of American and Western arms. Of course, in the companion podcast to War Notes, which is Chasing Ghost and Irregular Warfare podcast, which is available also at my Substack, you will discover that I've spent a whole lot of time there historically, contemporaneously, and dabbling a bit in conflict futurism, in which I have talked about just how poorly, just how incompetently, and just Brer Rabbit throw me in the briar patch has been the history of American arms since 1945. Now, that doesn't mean that Western arms in Western Europe and other Western nation states haven't done awful things themselves since 1945 and before that time. But what I really wanted to emphasize in that particular podcast, Chasing Ghost, is that small rubric of irregular warfare, that umbrella term that's employed for counterinsurgency, insurgency, guerrilla warfare, counter-guerrilla warfare, counterterrorism and terrorism, information warfare, hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, all those things that are sort of part and parcel apart from conventional conflict. Hence, I have taken the opportunity to make my excursions there real here in this completely new podcast. And because of circumstances of our time and this particular moment in the history of the United States, I wanted to try not only to reflect on, again, how poorly conventional arms are faring in the West and America in particular, but how can we get out of this mess? How can we revive, maybe even bring to a higher standard of behavior and conduct the military arms in the West? So that will be the raison d'etre of the following podcast series that you will hear. I've sketched out some notes. I've sketched out some scripts for what I think this is going to look like and what I anticipate. But what I find is it's much as in the novelist's craft, where you may, at the beginning of writing that novel, that work of fiction, you may have architected and sorted out what your characters are going to be, but they take on a life of their own and their own arcs as you write the book in how they behave with each other, and in the end, how they behave until they assume room temperature. So the goal of this particular podcast, if not this particular podcast series, is to try to put things in a perspective that is a little more optimistic than I am customarily used to doing in the other podcast, for instance, in which I will try to, on occasion, buttress here. So a little bit of housekeeping. I urge all of my listeners who have migrated over here and you are giving me a chance by listening to this new podcast that I put together, I wanted to thank you for that. I wanted to thank you for your solicitude and mentioning to others that Chasing Ghosts exists, if not that War Notes exists. Leaving reviews is really important to me at your favorite podcast vendor. I am forever obliged if you do so. I have a Substack. You will find that in the show notes. And if you wish to converse, because cross-examination is the engine of truth, and you have recommendations, maybe gentlemanly dissenting of opinions, that kind of thing, cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. That will serve as the locus for both Chasing Ghost and War Notes until I make amends otherwise. So today, what I'm going to do to kick this off is the title of this particular podcast is The Hermitage Kingdom, America Steps Back. And I'm going to make a number of broadly framed and imagined proposals here, which will set the stage in this larger auditorium of ideas to examine in follow-on podcast episodes the joint conduct of operations, the joint strategic and grand strategic theaters of war. I will go to the respective services to offer my observations and recommendations on what can be done to make it all work better, be more efficacious. I almost said efficient, but I have a bugbear about efficiency, and that's this. You can be efficient, but it doesn't make you effective. But if you're effective, most likely you are efficient. So with that, let's talk rather quickly about echelonments of warfare, the generations of warfare. Thank you, William Lind. And then to offer a very, very brief, probably one of the shortest introductions you'll have to strategy and grand strategy. And then I will make the case for America's retreat from the world. Mind you, this is not a retreat from the world in total, but a military retreat from the world, and I will make my case. There are four primary echelonments in the conduct of warfare, left of bang to what happens after success or failure occurs once battles or wars are engaged. And those would be tactical, operational, strategic, and grand strategic. Tactical would be all of those things that happen at the tip of the spear, the bloody spear point of all warfare, no matter land, naval, air, whatever the case may be. Operational would be, picture it as the conductor at the mid-level management who is taking all of those tactical echelonments that are available in his sphere of influence. In this case, most likely it is going to be division and below. And they are going to conduct their operations in a sensibility that allows them to look at the conflict more holistically and appropriately use and send in a, both a deliberate and a hasty fashion, more so in a deliberate fashion if you can help it, those tactical elements there to prosecute the stages of the battle or war that you wish to optimize and make more effective. At the strategic level, this is where you get the political, in the sense political as in nation state or nation states, that are starting to say to the operational and tactical levels, and they don't talk to the tactical levels at the strategic level because that's the operational level's job. Here you have the conductor, the choreographer, the architect at the strategic level that tries to do two things. Number one, at the requirements and conceptualization stage, left of bang in a conflict, what are the war aims? What forces do we have at our disposal? What is going to be done? What is going to be done if Murphy's Law, because remember, artillery is not the king of battle, Murphy is the king of battle. What is going to happen once this clash and dramatic collision between two or more complex adaptive systems, in this case, soldiers, airmen, Navy, Marines, clashing against others and near-peer and peer fights. For those who aren't aware, near-peer would be those that are just slightly less technologically and militarily able than the United States or the West, for instance. Peer would be those most likely who not only possess the nuclear weapons armaments that the U.S. and some of the NATO allies have, but also have the sophistication to be able to fight on more than one front and can field division-sized armies that number in the hundreds of thousands. Grand strategic, above that strategic level, is where that political military becomes much more political, and it is much more focused on How can we end the war quickly and effectively? And what will the world look like at its conclusion? I would not say it's a morally pristine example, but a good example of what this looks like in real life would be, for instance, Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin at their various conferences throughout the conduct of World War II, trying to figure out and chart what the world is going to look like post-conflict, because we all know that as in World War I and with World War II, whatever the world looked like and how it was arranged before those wars clacked off, it looks quite a bit different after the wars are allegedly concluded. Now, William Lind has had quite an influence on my thinking, and he is the one who, one can say, did he invent or did he discover, like Nassim Taleb with fragility and anti-fragility, I'm going to call it discovery. What he did is he articulated and elucidated three generations of warfare. Now, there are follow-ons, fourth and fifth gen, and we'll get into that briefly. And while military development is generally a continuous evolutionary process, as we've discussed before with revolutions and military affairs and things like that, the modern era has witnessed three watersheds in which that change has been quite qualitative. So modern military development comprises three distinct generations. First generation warfare reflects tactics of the era of the smoothbore musket, the tactics of line and column. These tactics were developed primarily in response to technological factors, as I've discussed previously with RMAs. The line maximized the firepower and the fire brought on various targets. Rigid drill was necessary to generate that high rate of fire. And this was even in the absence of operational art as we know it today, because it really didn't exist as a concept because of the way things were done, and most prominently in this would be Napoleon. Second generation warfare was a response to the rifled musket, the breech loaders, barbed wire, smokeless powder, the machine gun, indirect fire, and indirect tactics. The tactics were based on fire movement, and they remained essentially linear. The defense still attempted to prevent all penetrations, and in the attack, a laterally dispersed line advance by rushes in small groups, much like we see with fire and maneuver, with infantry fire teams and squads and platoons even today, even though that's changing as a result of the ubiquity of UAVs on the battlefield in that salvo competition, but we'll discuss that later. Second generation tactics were summed up in the French maxim, the artillery conquers, the infantry occupies. Massed firepower replaced massed manpower. Second generation tactics remain the basis of U.S. doctrine, believe it or not, and I agree with Lynn when he makes this claim into the 1980s. Now, second generation saw formal recognition and adoption of the operational art, initially by the Prussian Army, and all those Prussian Army attitudes and changes and the adoption of Auftragstaktik, which is mission type orders, where they have a character command in which, even though orders are being followed in the field, they trust, because of officer development and character assessment, that if changes have to be made, even those changes that seem to be the direct opposite of the intent of what the orders were left of bang, they would still be given a pass for doing so, because they are the ones as the instant commanders, as it were, who would know what's best as far as conducting that. Lynn contends, and I agree with this, although I think that tactics, techniques, and procedures, TTP, plays a big role in this too, because he says technology is the primary advancement modality. So in third generation warfare, and think of the second generation of warfare as almost, and there's going to be left and right permutations that are different from this, an attrition style warfare. Third generation warfare, it was also a response to the increase in battlefield firepower, especially at the end of the 19th century. However, the driving force was primarily ideas, aware they could not prevail in a contest of materiel because of their weaker industrial base in World War I. The Germans developed radically new tactics based on maneuver rather than attrition. Third generation tactics were the first truly non-linear tactics. The attack relied on infiltration to bypass and collapse the enemy's combat forces, rather than seeking to close with and destroy them. The defense was in-depth and often invited penetration, which set the enemy up for a counterattack. And of course, as I like to remind my listeners and readers of, remember that all wars are won by the least incompetent forces. I'll let you grok that as you wish. But in this case, what it meant, and of course, Liddell Hart, who was one of the authors, again, he didn't invent this. He observed it and discovered it, of the indirect approach in time. And also Colonel Boyd talks about this too, to a large extent, with his OODA loop theory, which is observation, orientation, decision, and action. And these led to rather not mundane, but rapid changes in warfare. I am fond, as I think Neil Ferguson is, of seeing World War I and World War II as the same conflict with a interwar interregnum that allowed them to become third generation armies for the most part at the beginning of World War II, and not simply this outlier in the conduct of third generation operations by the Germans in World War I. And then we see all of the combatants for the most part in World War II using variations of second and third generation warfare, more so third generation warfare, excepting the German Operation Barbarossa, launched in the summer of 1941 into Russia, very ill thought out, and they did not have the logistical means nor imagination to facilitate the blitzkrieg tactics, which had seized Western Europe in a little over a year. And we'll discuss this in much more depth and complexity in the future on a podcast episode, because it isn't wholly germane to me going down that rabbit hole right now. But for the most part, among all the factors that caused the German army to literally lose the war in 1941 because of Operation Barbarossa, it was two factors primarily that caused that to happen. I'd like to thank David Stahel, the Eastern Front historian, who has really turned around my understanding and how I grok what happened that summer of 1941 and the subsequent 2 years. Is they had immature logistics that, when you looked at them in detail, were just astonishing in complexity, variation, and I have to say, rank stupidity. And number two, the Germans had not thought through, surprisingly enough, this being the Wehrmacht, which was the successor to the Reichswehr in World War I, probably one of the most effective and efficient fighting formations since the Roman legions that the earth has seen. So not only the logistics, but also here with a German general staff, a very sophisticated officer and NCO selection and education process, professional military education, always looking in the rearview mirror at military history. They maintain military historians on the OKH staff. They had not figured out what happens when this third generation force, a maneuver force, becomes an attrition force. And so this collision between having the logistical immaturity and not quite having tackled what happens when you go from third generation warfare to second generation warfare, well, it led to calamity, of course, a cascade of calamities that eventually led to the denouement of Germany as a fighting force in April 1945. It took them nearly 4 years to perish. Now, fourth and fifth generation warfare tends to be those things that I cover in Chasing Ghost. That bifurcation between fourth and fifth gen usually turns into a linguistic food fight in the defense intelligentsia. So I would tell you, don't bother with it too much. But if you look at the rubric in fourth generation warfare as irregular warfare, quite literally, it is all those things that I described a few minutes ago at the beginning of this podcast episode. Now, I am intrigued by William Lind making the claim that America has been a second generation in attrition warfare complex for the most part into the 1980s, and that it was the 1980s that saw them take maneuver really seriously. And this would be mud to space maneuver. That would be a turn of phrase in an argo that's employed in the military that means that everything from the lower depths of the ocean where submarines are employed, nuclear submarines, for instance, all the way up to near space or in space when one is using the non-air-breathing space assets as intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance modalities, things like that, and everything in between. That's what the Argo mud to space means. So I talked to you about these things for several reasons. Number one, I wanted to acquaint you very briefly with strategy, because there are bookshelves out there on military strategy. I would call to your attention not only William Lind, but a fellow by the name of Colin Gray. I'll try to be sure to put that in the footnotes. And those are books that you can read in depth, and also Edvard Lutwak, who's one of my favorites. And he is a rather curmudgeonly but brilliant fellow. I don't even know if he's still alive. I think he is, but I'll bet he's still kicking, because he's a kick in the pants when it comes to intellectual riposte and rhetoric and things like that. He's just brilliant. Well, he's written on what was the strategy and grand strategy of the Roman Empire, what was the strategy and grand strategy of the West, and he's written a number of books on that. He's written books on the taxonomy of coups, to include coup de main and all the rest. So Lutwak, Colin Gray, William Lind, and Martin van Creveld would be four of the authors I would recommend to my listeners and readers who are interested in getting more strategically fluent and smart about that. So for our purposes here, I want you to take one thing away from strategy, and I have to thank John Boyd for this, and I'm going to paraphrase. John Boyd says, and if you're able to read some of, believe it or not, he didn't write very many books, but he had this one PowerPoint presentation that I will be sure to put in the footnotes for you to read that talked about strategy, grand strategy, the Oder Loop, and how warfare has changed in the 20th century and how it will be changing into the 21st century. Brilliant guy, sort of a polymath, not only brilliant when it came to elucidating how strategy and grand strategy and by extension operational art works, but one of the designers of the F-16, I think that he dabbled in the A-10, not certain, but there are, as a matter of fact, there's podcasts out there like Mark McGrath's podcast, which you'll find on Substack, that speaks to Boyd. So he probably speaks to Boyd with much more depth and alacrity than I do. But what I want to do here in paraphrasing Boyd is this. What does strategy, what is its distillation for those of us who don't spend our lives in a cubicle or an office being paid the big bucks in the defense intelligentsia or the advocacy tanks? I call them advocacy tanks, not think tanks, because I want to be precise in what they are. But we're not paid to do that, and most of my listeners are not paid to do that. So what is the distillation and simplicity of what strategy is? Boyd would tell us that strategy is the gainful employment and incentivization of alliances and the isolation of enemies. That's what it comes down to. That's what one is trying to do in that chess game called war, even left of bang, to forego potential conflicts by seeking peaceful rapprochements, or even that four-letter word. I don't think it's a four-letter word, appeasement. Appeasement to me, to a certain extent, is simply compromise on coexistence on the earth. And other matters when it comes to strategy can be drawn out of that. But I think for the most part, that captures the large amount of the bell curve on what strategy renders a nation state or a nation state that is in a coalition with other similarly thinking nation states. Now, let's move on to another concept. And we're going to put a bow on all of this, but I'm trying to introduce these concepts so that, and if I'm boring you because you already know them, well, there it is, repetition is the father of mastery. So in this case, I've done episodes in Chasing Ghosts where I talked about what's called conflict complexes, regional conflict complexes. And it speaks to two things. Number one, it speaks to the fact that war is much more complex than you make it out to be when it comes to actually uncorking the bottle, letting the genie out, and letting your war cry fly, because you start to take the embers or maybe the very cold ashes of previous conflicts that are caused by tribe, clan differences, geopolitical map making by the West on those who didn't have a say in it, who actually live in that country. And it sort of uncorks and blows oxygen into the embers of previous conflicts that had settled down that once again burst into flame. Those are regional conflict complexes. And what that means is that for the most part, they are going to be near hegemons. A hegemon, whether regional or global, and there's very few global hegemons, the US and Romans come to mind as some of those exceptions in history, is a power in a region. Let's say Iran as a regional hegemon, China as a regional hegemon, Russia as a regional hegemon. Some take on the character of military regional hegemons. Some take on the character of composite military soft power hegemons, soft power being everything used short of military power to influence, shape, and potentially dominate regions that are either contiguous or non-contiguous to the hegemons that are trying to influence and shape the world around them. Hegemonic influence wafts and wanes. The ambitious global hegemons have the most difficult job of all, and the U.S., for instance, considers itself a unipower, a hyperpower. The sole surviving superpower above all other superpowers. I don't know what that word, a superpower, whatever the case may be. But nonetheless, it has this conceit since the end of 1945 that it sits at the head of the table and that NATO and its Pacific allies and wherever they find them planet-wide, well, you better listen to what the U.S. has to say because they're the ones in charge. They are in charge of planet Earth. From the North Pole to the South Pole, from the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere, and all around the equator, the U.S. is in charge. That has been the hubristic statement. But nonetheless, we've seen since 1945, as I seem to have to mention endlessly, the United States, and I would say to a lesser extent, its NATO allies, for instance, has an almost pristine record of defeat and stalemate in all military campaigns outside of its contiguous borders. Now, there are plenty of reasons for that. It's like with all things, when you conduct a root cause analysis, what you find is that there are proximate causes that through drilling, Socratic drilling, lead you down to the root cause, but that root cause tends to be several root causes. And also, we have to make a distinction between correlative and causative. Correlative being a lesser evidentiary need to say, well, these things sort of sync together, but they're not necessarily related. Whereas causative means that there is usually a linear line that leads from the root cause to the proximate causes to what we see in observed behavior in the natural world and the conduct of the militaries and the conduct of wars and such. You can use that, especially with this almost bloodless practicum for you and I sitting comfortably in our armchairs, in our studies, reading of all these battles and military campaigns throughout the last 3,000 years of human history, where we can do that and we can look at that and we can come to our own conclusions, as I have talked about when it comes to topical reading. If you'll read 3 to 5 books on the same subject, you will tend to become quite expert if you're an active reader, an active interrogator. You know what your bias filter is. You know what their bias filter is. You can get that beloved, in my mind, single most accurate picture of just what happened. The reason the Roman Empire is no more and the reason it was a global hegemon that turned to dust is because all empires turned to dust. That's a fact. And this is going to disturb some of my listeners, but this is also a fact. America is an empire. It has been an empire since it first tried to take troops onto the Korean Peninsula in 1871. And this would be extra contiguous empire, not the Mexican-American War and the wars of aggregation against the indigenous aboriginals in America from coast to shining coast. No, this would be the extraterritorial ambitions that Once those indigenous aboriginals had been bested and practically genocided, then America could look overseas and try to join the colonial club, as it were. Didn't work out too well in 1871, but of course, the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom on January 17, 1893, and its later annexation to the United States in 1898 being the identical year in which the Philippines and Cuba and other Spanish holdings, Spanish colonial holdings, came under the fire of the American military. And of course, those were suborned into the growing American empire. And from there, one can look around the world at direct imperial holdings and indirect imperial holdings and discover that astride the world, the American empire has been quite large. And of course, it has been quite brutal. And using the military, for instance, throughout the southern hemisphere, going below the American border during the late 19th and during the almost the entirety of the 20th century, especially when they could cling to the Monroe Doctrine to rationalize why they were interfering in all these other extra contiguous nation states, America was astride the world after 1945. And of course, all the colonial systems and superpowers, for the most part, between 1945 and 1962, where you would see the French finally leaving their 130 years, probably when the Pétain Noir came in the 1830s into Algeria. Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco being part of what was considered metropolitan France at the time. So for the most part, the Belgians lost their colonies. The French lost their colonies. The Portuguese lost their colonies in the 1980s. All of it started to dissolve. But between 1945 and 1962 was when the majority of those European colonial powers had either sundered or surrendered whatever their holdings were around the world. As a matter of fact, I think that the Portuguese may have been some of the last holdouts when it came to the African colonies like Angola, were well into the 1980s. They had sort of a tenuous possession of those. But for the most part, excepting America, all of these colonial powers lost them, with Great Britain, of course, which had been astride the world where the sun would never set on the British Empire, where by 1948, with the loss of India, they had a collection of rocks by the name of Pitcairn Island, Diego Garcia, and the Falkland Islands around the world, but nothing more to speak of as far as the proud adornments of the imperial crown overseas. So I've given you all of these preambles for a very important reason, because I'm going to make a proposition here. I am going to say that not only is it extraordinarily expensive, not only is it fraught with moral injury, not only is this a practical and ineffectiveness problem for the United States to stand astride the world as a global hegemon, running hither and thither, putting its finger in the dikes of emerging regional conflict complexes, getting in the way of regional hegemons conducting, even though they may be odious, but nonetheless, conducting what they do by the state of nature and the way nation states behave in the genuinely anarchical system of international relations, there's only so much that America can do as a hyperpower, especially as its military weakens decade after decade in effectiveness, especially in the 21st century, due to a variety of things that I covered in episode one of the War Notes podcast. But quite frankly, the United States is incapable of cashing the checks and fulfilling the ambitious program it has set for itself, policing the planet. And it's all starting to fall apart, especially now in the 21st century. Because the American military, thanks to the Soviet collapse and all of the Stan brothers on the underbelly that calved off of Russia, at the time, all of a sudden, in 1991, you have America astride the world with NATO saying, we've got this. We're in charge. And of course, remember too, in 1991, NATO made promise after promise, the U.S. made promise after promise that it would not flow eastward towards Russia, because Russia had made it very clear to the West time after time, whether it was wearing its Tsarist regalia, its Soviet regalia, or the post-Soviet regalia, you shall not pass when it comes to certain buffer countries, Ukraine being one of them. Remember that it was the present director of the CIA, William Byrne, who was then in 2008, the ambassador to Moscow, who sent a cable to the State Department that read, and I'm paraphrasing, "The bright red line for the Russians is NATO encouragement or NATO blustering to get the Ukraine into NATO." They did not want that. They made that clear, and they made it clear as a bell time and again, and the U.S. insisted on pushing by the 2008 and 2014 domestic color revolutions conducted by the West and the intelligence agencies in the West, primarily the three-letter agencies in America, to force the function of making sure that they could shape and influence the political landscape to make entrance into NATO for the Ukraine more palatable for the Ukrainians, much to the Russians' disappointment. And in this case, what I want to talk about is here I've laid the stage, the groundwork for why I think that one can be a global hegemon, a hyperpower, as it were, as the U.S. prided itself on towards the end of the 20th century. But the 21st century has brought on new revolutions in military affairs. The 20th century has seen these exquisite platforms. Exquisite platforms are things like carriers and F-35s and expensive tanks. These multi-million dollar modalities that you can't make a whole lot of them. And remember what Stalin said, that quantity has a quality all of its own in that enormous, I would consider it a revolution in military affairs, this rapid and just once in an historical lifetime transformation of the Soviet forces from 1943 to 1945 to become this military behemoth and gigantic monster that would quite literally consume the German army, because 4/5 of all German order of battle were arrayed against the Russians from the summer of 1941 until May of 1945, when the German candle finally went out for the Nazis. Something very awful happened in the West between 1946 and 1950. I'm not going to call it a coup. I may call it an intellectual coup. I may call it a moral coup, but I can't really call it a coup that Eduard Luttwak would approve of as fitting into his taxonomy. But the intelligence agencies in the West, especially in the United States, were faced with a conundrum. We're going to create a central intelligence agency, and this organ is going to do two things. Number one, it is going to provide the top drawer and most sophisticated analysis of world events so that forecasts, or with more evidence, predictions can be given to decision makers in the political class in America, and by extension, the West, in order to make more informed decisions so that the national security milieu planet-wide would be neutral or beneficial to America and the West. Okay, I'll buy that. Number two, and in my mind, a little more craven, immoral, and downright evil in a lot of respects, was the clandestine organizations. Was all of those organizations that would conduct espionage, that would conduct color revolutions, that would conduct armed insurrection support, that would train armed insurgents around the world. Everything from 1953 with the Shah of Iran, everything from what happened in Vietnam. You can look at the whole sordid, sorry history of U.S. intelligence failures planet-wide, and they are so grateful to have this very sophisticated and blanket-like classification regime that isn't used necessarily to protect sources and people, but to protect the American people and maybe the Earth from seeing the moral malfeasance and just absolute infamous behavior of those organizations in trying to influence and shape things to fit what, in this case, the U.S., the hyper-hegemon, needs to benefit their own security apparatus. In this podcast format, I certainly can't go over the detailed, almost encyclopedic cavalcade of calamities that is U.S. intelligence clandestine operations planet-wide since the end of World War II, but I recommend two books to you. That would be Legacy of Ashes by Michael Weiner and Ghosts of Langley by John Prado. I will put that in the show notes. If you get the chance and you can stand the moral corruption and the staining of your soul that will result from reading those, you will be so disgusted that if you're not, you should take your moral turpitude into question. So I'm finished framing my house. I'm finished framing my equation. I'm finished with all the preambles left of bang for the proposal that I have. And here's my bloody radical proposal. America needs to come home. America needs to abandon those 750 bases, military bases that we're aware of in 80 different countries around the world and stop meddling. M-E-D-D-L-I-N-G. Stop meddling. Come home, take a knee, drink water, reevaluate, reassess, reframe, and revolutionize the paradigm that the Department of Defense does. In other words, the Department of Defense, maybe we have an opportunity with this new political realignment that is emerging in America to make them be serious about the second word and the title of that organization. Because guess what? There are tens of thousands of nuclear munitions planet-wide. I'm going to say that one can say that there are thousands. I won't go so far as to say tens of thousands, because I think in all the inventories, as far as rocketry is concerned, and as far as bombs are concerned, a lot of those are long in the tooth. A lot of those maintenance systems are arthritic and sclerotic. We've had a number of instances, even with recent missile firings, in this case, Germans and British, where once they launched said missiles, things didn't fare well. We have the aging Minuteman 1, 2, and 3 in our terrestrial land-based missile silos, which are very, very long in the tooth. Up until, I think, 4 years ago, we're still using 5, 7, 8-inch floppies, whatever the case may be. I may have the dimensions in the hazard, but nonetheless, they were using floppy disks from the 60s and 70s for the fire control mechanisms for firing these missiles. We have these aging glide bombs and bombs that are used by terrestrial bombers like the B-52. The B-1B, I don't think there's very many B-1Bs capable of making those long trips anymore, because even they're getting long in the tooth. And I had mentioned before at my blog postings at the Libertarian Institute, in which I take a chainsaw to the DOD and the Western military complexes on their frailties, foibles, and failures, is they doubled the B-52 shelf life from 50 to 100 years, because all the interim replacements for the 52, to include the B-1B, the F-117, which had a brief life, and then, of course, the B-2, which is going to be decommissioned, have not fared very well. And then, of course, we have submarine launch munitions, which I find myself very much in favor of, because I think that if we had to really cut back on spending at that level for munitions, the one thing that you would want to keep would be the virtually undetectable, I'm putting that in air quotes because technology moves apace, virtually undetectable launch platforms and SSBNs and boomer submarines, which have the submarine launched missiles. And most of these missiles can launch, reach a significant altitude, and release multiple payloads of multiple warheads, which, by the way, come in since the 1950s at speeds that exceed Mach 5, which technically speaking is a hypervelocity munition. So hypervelocity munitions aren't necessarily new. The application of them at the tactical level is what is new. So my proposal, And hence the title of this particular podcast episode, The Hermitage Kingdom, America Steps Back. I think it is time for America to say, we're going to wash our hands of police actions planet-wide that aren't our business. For instance, if you look at the behavior in Africa since the end of World War II, and you take a look at Africa today, here's what you find. American influence is waning to such a degree that the majority of the countries use Russian military advisors. I say again, the majority of countries. And then the majority of countries use China and its soft power that it employs. And I'm not here to tell you that that Chinese soft power is just done because of altruism. It's just done to make the world a better place. None of that happens. But nonetheless, they are masters at using soft power, which is left of bang, not military power, to influence, shape, cajole political classes, and by extension with the Russians, military classes, into doing what is good for those particular regional hegemons, in this case, the Chinese and the Russians. The U.S. has spent so much time bullying, cajoling, conducting military missteps, hiring on and subsidizing abusive regimes, and I'm not excusing the other regional hegemons from not engaging in the very same behavior, but there's really nothing to show for what America has done in all of these things outside of Europe and outside of those curious little islands on the Pacific Rim that are outside of Chinese Third Island Chain. Not much. So I was mentioning that nuclear salvo competition, those thousands of warheads that could rain down on America in a nuclear conflagration, or maybe even a conventional conflagration. As a matter of fact, let's do a thought experiment. Let's say to ourselves that Russia and or China or India in the future, or whatever the future portends, because none of us really know what's going to happen beyond the next 10 years. I will give you another thought experiment, and that is this. Those of you still on this planet, and you were adults in 1990, could you have envisioned what the internet would do to revolutionize the way people behave in social media, by extension, the way people behave by 2010, a mere 20 years into the future? No one could. Remember our friend Bill Gates said in the 90s, he said, the internet is just a fad. It's just a thing. America doesn't have a means to defend itself against conventional or nuclear munitions that are inbound to America proper, or to Alaska, or to Hawaii, or to the territories that are supported like Puerto Rico or places like that. As a matter of fact, it has a mid-course interceptor program. And guess what? That mid-course interceptor program, which is expressly designed to take down these incoming hypervelocity munitions when they come in, not only does it have a really high failure rate in testing, but we have 44 of them in the U.S. inventory. And here's one thing that you may not be aware of, and from my engineering background, I happen to know this. I may have engineers in my audience. If I have an incoming munition, and this is especially if there's terminal maneuvering or a speed beyond Mach 5, if you have that, do you send one round to go up there to take it out, in this case, a missile, that an interceptor that would go up to take it? No, because you have a probability of kill. That means you have to send four up there. By the way, is it going to be shoot, look, shoot, or shoot, shoot, look? In other words, are you going to fire one, wait, see if it lands, and then fire another one? Or are you going to shoot two, and then look, and make your battle damage intelligence and assessment later on to know what target has been serviced? Because in the end, with salvo competition, which is what all of this comes down to, these are wars of leakers. So 44 mid-course interceptors in the U.S. inventory to defend the homeland, and you must send four aloft. You know what I'm going to do for my listeners? I'm going to say, we'll send two aloft, and that's a guaranteed 80% probability of kill. That means that 20% of those are going to come in. 44. Well, they've got $1 trillion. When you take the DO, the Department of Energy extracts and excursions for nuclear weapons design and things like that. America spends almost $1 trillion on defense, but it doesn't spend it on defense. It spends it on complex weapon systems, on exquisite platforms like the carrier, which is nothing more than a 21st century variant of the crossbow and the chariot, and they're all future fish apartments if any of them get near the Chinese coast, because carriers today, as are all exquisite platforms, are missile sponges. Manned tanks are missile sponges. Everything is a missile sponge. All these manned modalities that we're so fond of in the West, and especially the United States, whether it is a plane, a ship, a submarine, a tank, an infantry fighting vehicle, any of those things, this is a revolution in military affairs. And if you don't believe me, I recommend you go back to the fall of 2020, take a look at Nagorno-Karabakh in the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and you will see everything laid before you that you would later see in the special military operation conducted by the Russians into the Ukraine proper and what we're seeing there now. What we have done, what the United States has done, is they have taken all of these exquisite platforms, all of these integrated air and missile defense systems, and you can name all of them from Patriot to THAAD to ground mid-course interceptors and all and everything in between. And what you see is that they are being employed in a fashion in the Ukraine that allows the Russians, who are very able students of war, to take notes, take a knee themselves, and as regional hegemons, make changes to their tactics, techniques, and procedures. Know where they have to change their technology. Know where their war investments have to go to best the peer foe of the United States and its NATO allies in this case. What I'm telling you is that regional hegemons have a distinct advantage, and nothing stops the United States from becoming a regional hegemon. Why is it that we have a country in the United States that if it took every air launch interceptor, every one of its integrated air missile defense interceptors for incoming munitions in its inventory and had to defend the West Coast of the United States, would have trouble defending in whole half of San Diego County? But then we go across the Pacific Ocean to the Chinese, very sophisticated, very in-depth, integrated air and missile defense system, what they call A2AD, which is aerial access, aerial denial, that is not only wide, but it is deep, and it has redundancy, and it can stop an incursion or an invasion. When you look at that, you think to yourself, well, why are the regional hegemons, and the same thing could be said of Russia if you take a look at the fact that they own 55% of the Arctic Circle, and they have had permanent human habitation there, along with ports of debarkation, icebreakers, and things like that, for decades. America doesn't. The Russians have an excess of 40-plus icebreakers. My listeners can probably inform me of the exact number. America has 1.5. It's just, it's a crisis in detail, and it's a crisis in whole for the United States, that it simply cannot continue to do business as usual in developing exquisite platforms. If you look at the U.S. Navy, for instance, you find that since the successful Arleigh Burke Hull that was finally commissioned in 1991, in the time between 1991 and 2025, there has been not one single ship that has been designed and commissioned by the United States Navy, such as the Zumwalt, or the Ford carrier, which can't reliably retrieve and launch aircraft, or the little crappy ships, the LCS ships. Not any of those systems, those exquisite platforms that have been spent hundreds of billions of dollars on, work. None of them work effectively, and no one has lost their jobs. Not a uniform, not an SES, not a Department of Navy employee, not a contractor, no one. No one has lost their job. By the way, humans are built on incentives. If you continue to deliver crap and you're not going to be prosecuted, lose your job, or pay fines, or find yourself in a civil or criminal court as a result of your malfeasance, you're going to continue to do that. Because if you subsidize something, in this case, failure and this kind of nepotistic, entropic universe that all of the defense military complex engages in, of course, you're going to get the garbage at the end of it because of the garbage that went into it. I'm going to make a forecast, not a prediction, and that's this. In the next near-peer-to-peer fight that America gets itself into, maybe along with its NATO allies, maybe along with some of its allies on the Pacific Rim, America will lose badly. They may look good in the first 24 to 48 hours in shock and awe, but after that, they are going to lose badly, and they are going to lose in detail. And I can almost assure you that this is going to happen. So my whole notion, my whole conceit, my proposition that America relent, take a knee, and become a regional hegemon, and be concerned about the homeland, and be concerned about Alaska by extension, Hawaii by extension, and the protection of some of our friends and territories and such, but try to confine it not to the planet, maybe to the hemisphere. My preference would be confining it to the northern hemisphere, where CONUS happens to be. Start making the people put their foot to the fire in the Pentagon. Tell them your first job is defense. Your second job is war making, maybe invasion, whatever the case may be, even though I find invasions from other countries absolutely outlandish as something that could happen as a military force. Because I want to make sure that I call out my exception to that, which is what I've covered in my Storming America podcast, episodes 37, 41 through 43, and 49 through 50, in Chasing Ghost, where I talk about an upscaled, Muslim-inspired, most likely Gaza-like incursion into the U.S. in which hundreds of thousands of Americans will die and millions of Americans will be injured and wounded, and the country will face an internal calamity that it hasn't seen since 1860. So here is my plea. In short, come home. Establish your priorities for defense of the nation. Stop making war abroad. Stop supporting war abroad. Stop subsidizing people fighting against each other in these endless regional conflict complexes planet-wide. Because guess what? From the western reaches of Mali to Pakistan and everything in between, and of course, September 2023, before the October 7th incursion into Israel, Egypt was the sole bead on that band I just described that wasn't in conflict. Now they're in conflict. The world is aflame. The world isn't aflame simply because of U.S. interference, but I would say largely because U.S. interference. It is time for the U.S. to come home, to regroup, to recalibrate, to find what it takes to defend the homeland and then work our way outward, not to conduct these endless wars, to provoke endless wars, and to project power in a fashion that is so irresponsible and so costly that it does is increases the national debt. It increases the deficit by extension, and it just makes the world a much worse place. And I want to leave you with this thought. Since 1945 until this time, what you've seen around the world, what all of us have grown up around, is this relatively peaceful interregnum in the Northern Hemisphere, excepting some war that has broken out. That is relatively peaceful. That's over with now. And the U.S. is, to a large extent, one of the primary authors of why it's over, because it has developed and incentivized such a frayed and warlike international ecosystem that the world is on the brink of going to war permanently again. Because before 1945, the world was at war. But there was an interesting interregnum, and that was the 19th century, except for colonial conflicts and such, and of course the French-German imbroglios in the 1870s, the world was relatively at peace. Before then, not so much. 19th century, war went into overdrive. 21st century, America has picked fights consistently that end in stalemate or defeat. At $1 trillion a pop per year to fund the war apparatus of the United States. So my plea is rather simple. I'm not saying let's not be a global hyperpower forever, even though if I had my way, that would be the end state I would seek. What I'm saying is that why can't America be realistic and tell itself it's time to be a regional hegemon, with some exceptions, if Americans are in danger abroad? I recall that brilliant movie with Brian Keith playing Teddy Roosevelt, in which he says, Petty Karas alive or Raisuli dead. You guys can look that up. I'll put it in the footnotes. Very amusing. But nonetheless, let's come home. Let's refit. Let's revise. Let's recalibrate. And let's figure out whether the path forward is war on the world or defending the U.S. Thank you for listening to episode 2 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can write me at cgpodcast@pm.me, or you can visit my Substack. That should be in the footnotes. So with that, I appreciate your comments, your questions, whatever the case may be. If you enjoyed this, please leave a positive review on your podcast vendor. I would be obliged. This is Bill out.